So what are the nuclear risks and opportunities in the Trump administration? And what can the president do about North Korea without China's support? Senator John McCain is clearly hot on the trail of, quote, that crazy fat kid running the country. So what might be a solution? We invite Joe Cirincione to the podium to tell us what those risks and opportunities might be. And short of Weight Watchers, I can't think of a clear path for North Korea. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mimi, and thank you, Greg and Donna. I'm a sucker for Naples. I love coming here. My sister used to live here. It's always a pleasure to come, so give me a week's notice. I'll come down. On January 20th of this year, Donald J. Trump was sworn in as the 45th President of the United States. And after the ceremony, after his speech, he went back into the Capitol. But it was more than just lunch he had. He got his first nuclear briefing. This is the tradition. This is the way it's done. The new president is instructed as to the procedures for a nuclear emergency, for what he should do and how he should do it should the country be faced with the threat of a nuclear attack. And shortly thereafter, you started to see the pictures of the military officer who accompanies every president of the United States. An officer accompanied Barack Obama to the inaugural stage on that day, but when Donald Trump left, the officer was switched to him. This officer has to be there within a minute of the president at all times. When the president sleeps in the White House, an officer is stationed right outside. When the president goes down to Mar-a-Lago, the officer goes with him. When the president gets in an elevator, other VIPs have to wait. The officer goes in with him. And you see that he's carrying a black briefcase with him. You may have seen the pictures of Rick, the officer who was with him at Mar-a-Lago just a few weeks ago, that eager tourist snapped. Inside that briefcase is an attaché case that looks exactly like this. This is a zero Halliburton briefcase. To the best of our knowledge, this is still the briefcase that they use for carrying the command and controls to our nuclear weapons. Inside this suitcase is a briefing book that gives the President of the United States the plans and options for launching a nuclear strike. One weapon, 1,000 weapons. We keep on the ready to launch up to 1,000 nuclear weapons that can be launched within 4 minutes of a decision to do so. The President of the United States carries in his pocket a little card that looks like the kind of card that you would use to get into your hotel room. That's called the biscuit. It has the authorization code for the president. Should he decide to launch a nuclear weapon, he calls on the communication equipments, he will be put in touch with the national command, a military command. He will identify himself. He will give the code. Once the command authority knows that this is actually the President of the United States, they are duty-bound to follow his orders. And this is the first risk that is represented by the President of the United States. There's always a risk that a president could make a bad decision. I would say with this president, rather untested in these areas, more impetuous than most, there's a heightened risk, which is why you heard so much about this during the campaign and why you still hear the risks of nuclear war associated with this president and this presidency. It's not just that the president has the authority to launch a nuclear response when under attack. He could do it whenever he wants. The president is the only person in the United States that can authorize the use of a nuclear weapon. There is no one that can contradict the president when they give that order. There is no cabinet meeting required. There is no consent of Congress. There's no opportunity for an appeal to the Supreme Court. The system is set up to be decisive and rapid. When the president gives the order, it is verified. Usually it passes from the president to the Secretary of Defense, to the head of the Strategic Command, and then sent out to the deployed troops. Someone in that chain could refuse to carry out the order. They would be removed and replaced with someone who would implement the order. Command officers in our silos, on our submarines, who show hesitation about following out that order are removed. Under a nuclear attack, the idea is that we have to be able to quickly respond before the enemy missiles hit us. But we could also use the missiles first. And this is one of the things that gives people concern about the current president. He has talked rather loosely about the use of these weapons. He has talked about the possibility of using nuclear weapons against ISIS. Some of his advisors suggest, just last week, that the president should be prepared to use nuclear weapons against North Korea. Again, if the president decides to do so, it is his decision and his decision alone. As Richard Nixon said, I can go into my office, pick up the phone, and in 30 minutes, 70 million people would be dead. Now, why do we still have a system like that? Why is the Congress authorized to declare war, and only the Congress, except for the war that matters most? Why is the speed of the system set up that way? These are all very good questions, and in fact, Congress is debating these kinds of questions right now. There is a bill in Congress introduced by Senator Markey and Congressman Ted Lieu that says in the case of a decision to use a weapon first, so not when we're under attack, but in a decision to use a nuclear weapon first, the president must go and seek the authorization of Congress to bring in the most democratic institution in our government to get their approval before it. This is a controversial bill. But these are the kinds of discussions that were now happening in Washington. This is probably the greatest nuclear risk you face in the presidency, and I would like to outline two more and then switch to the opportunities. The possibilities that Donald Trump could improve several of our nuclear dangers, could reduce the nuclear risks. But let me march through the other two risks. The second great risk you have with this president is that he might encourage other countries to get nuclear weapons. During the campaign, he talked about the possibility that Japan or South Korea could, even should, get nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia should get nuclear weapons. It's inevitable, he said. No, there's nothing inevitable about the spread of nuclear weapons. In fact, more countries have given up nuclear weapons and programs to develop nuclear weapons over the last 30 years than have decided to try and get them. We are on a steady downward path. There are actually fewer countries with nuclear weapons or programs now than there were 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. Our policies, Democratic and Republican, liberal and conservative, have worked to stem, if not completely eliminate, the threat of proliferation. We have never encouraged another country to get a nuclear weapon. We didn't want Great Britain to get a nuclear weapon in 1950. We didn't want France to build a nuclear weapon in 60. We didn't want Israel to get nuclear weapons in 68. Those countries went and got them anyway, but it wasn't with our assistance. It wasn't because we thought this was a good thing. The basic view of the United States for 72 years has been what John F. Kennedy said. If many nations, large and small, stable and unstable, have nuclear weapons, it greatly increases global instability. It creates the possibility that every crisis will become a nuclear crisis, drawing in the great powers, increasing the risk of great power conflict. So we have worked against this policies for all these years. Will President Trump continue that trend, or will he go with this view that nuclear weapons are good and should be spread? The third possible risk is that the president will dismantle, as he said during the campaign, dismantle the Iran deal. 18 months ago, I was here talking to you about the Iran deal just as it was coming into force. The president campaigned against it, said it was a terrible deal, the worst deal he'd ever seen, that our negotiators didn't know what they were doing, and that once he came into office, he would dismantle it. If he does so, remember, this is a multinational agreement. We negotiated this with our allies, France and Germany and Great Britain, with Russia and China. It is a seven-party agreement. If we were to pull out of this agreement, our allies would not come with us. As they said, if you walk away, you walk away alone. That means the sanctions regime that got Iran to the negotiating table in the first place, that was the incentive for Iran to negotiate, would more or less rapidly collapse, and with it, all restraints on Iran's nuclear program. They would no longer be contained by the restrictions they agreed to as part of this accord. In other words, you'd have the worst of all possible worlds. You'd have Iran restarting its program, off to the races, no sanctions available to try to rein in that behavior, and you'd be putting us on a path to war. The only way to stop that program would be military action. So those are the three risks. Here's the good news. There are some real opportunities with this president. One of Donald Trump's priorities, in addition to building the wall and smashing ISIS, has been improving relations with Russia. Now, the situation doesn't look the same as it did during the campaign, but still, this is still one of his priorities. Wouldn't it be a good thing, he said, if the U.S. and Russia cooperated? It is almost impossible to imagine a different relationship with Russia that doesn't include a nuclear component. It always has. We have negotiated agreements with Russia that have reduced steadily the number of nuclear weapons both countries have. There are about 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world. 95% of them are held by the United States and Russia. We have about 7,000, they have about 7,000, and we've been steadily reducing these arsenals. That's still a lot of nuclear weapons, enough to destroy human civilization several times over, but it used to be much worse. There used to be 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world during the Cold War, before Ronald Reagan started cutting them. Ronald Reagan reached agreements with then Soviet Union to cut their arsenals in half. H.W. Bush cut them in half again. W. Bush cut them in half again. In fact, it is only Republican presidents that are able to make deep reductions to nuclear weapons. Clinton and Obama trimmed at the margin, a few hundred each removed from the arsenal. And the reason is obvious once you start to think about it. It's politics. A Republican president can make an agreement to cut nuclear weapons and he will win the support of his party. People have confidence in him. The American public generally trusts Republican presidents more on national security issues. So he brings the Republican Party with him, the Democrats come along. Such treaties then pass overwhelmingly in the U.S. Senate. If a Democrat tries to make the same agreement, the Republicans block against him as being weak on national security, appeasing our enemies. He starts to lose Democratic support. It is a fight, and almost always a losing fight. In fact, Barack Obama was the only Democratic president to negotiate and then get Senate approval of an arms reduction treaty. So if I was voting my interests, I'd be voting for Republicans. Republicans are the ones who can reduce the nuclear risk, and there is a very strong possibility that sometime in the president's term he will be able to do this. Remember Ronald Reagan. He began very strong, very hard, military buildup, an increase in the nuclear weapons budget, just like Donald Trump is proposing. The single biggest increase in his budget is for nuclear weapons, an 11% jump he wants in the nuclear weapons budget, part of his 10% increase for defense spending overall. But in the second term of Ronald Reagan, he made dramatic reductions. He not only stopped the arms race, he reversed it and set us on the course we've been following since the late 1980s. Can Donald Trump do the same? It's possible. It's possible. It's not like military commanders are demanding nuclear weapons. They do what the commander-in-chief tells them to. We have so many weapons. They keep them in reliable, safe, and effective, ready to use them. But there hasn't been a military mission that required the use of nuclear weapons in 72 years. And we've been in wars, we have lost wars, we have had our allies lose wars, we have lost thousands of troops in wars, and not once have we used a nuclear weapon. So nuclear weapons are seen as an outdated system, something that's not suited to the demands and challenges of the 21st century, particularly since the Cold War has now been over for 25 years. Do you need some? Almost certainly. Do you need all that we now have? Certainly not. So that's the first great opportunity. The second great opportunity is to that with that fat, crazy kid, Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un is the leader of North Korea. As a candidate, Donald Trump said he would negotiate with Kim Jong-un. Why not? Why not? I wouldn't go there, he said, but of course I'd be willing to talk. So it is possible that Donald Trump could make an agreement with Kim Jong-un to at least freeze that country's nuclear program. For the same reason, Republicans would never trust a Democrat to make a deal with Kim Jong-un. In fact, when Democrats have made deals, they have been attacked for appeasement, the deals have been attacked for giveaways, and they've steadily been undermined. A Republican makes it? No. Completely flips the politics. So Donald Trump can do something that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama could never do. Right now, just today, it was announced that the administration has completed its review of North Korea policy. We don't know what that review found. We don't know what the results are. I have some guesses. But soon, the president will start to, presumably, unfold that strategy and try to implement that strategy. It might start as soon as Thursday here in Florida. At Mar-a-Lago, the President of the United States is meeting with the President of China, Xi Jinping. China is key to solving the North Korea crisis. If it's not that we can outsource the North Korean problem to China. China can't solve it on their own, both because they don't want to solve it on their own, and the North Koreans want something China can't give them. They want security assurances from us. They want to know that if they freeze their program or reduce their program, that we're not going to be coming after them the way, they say, we came after Saddam Hussein, the way we came after Libya's President Muammar Gaddafi. The lesson for the North Koreans is you give up your nuclear program, your regime gets eliminated. Can the great deal maker make a deal? It's possible. It's out there. There is no shortage of Republican Korean specialists who are willing to advise the president. I teach at Georgetown University. Victor Chu is one of the leading China experts. There's rumors that he might come into the administration soon. If they ever get around to appointing officials at the State Department and the Department of Defense, you might see people like Victor being brought in. This is not a subject that's without debate. There are factions within the Republican Party who favor regime change. There are others who say there is no military solution. But it is happening. It's not a Republican Democratic, it's not a liberal conservative issue, it is a general geostrategic diplomatic debate that crosses party lines, that crosses political ideologies. And finally, the last great opportunity you have with Donald Trump is that he could not only keep the Iran deal, he could improve it. In fact, the arrows are pointing in that direction. He hasn't made a single move against the Iran deal yet. Why? Because all his advisors are telling him to keep the deal. Secretary of Defense Mattis, a man I know and respect, a man I've had many conversations with, a man I talked with when he was the commander-in-chief of the Central Command, commander of the Central Command. He told us then that he wakes up in the morning and he thinks about three threats: Iran, Iran, Iran. He hates the Iranians. He holds them responsible for the death of U.S. servicemen and women in Iraq, in Lebanon. But he says, keep the deal. Rex Tillerson, no fan of the Iranians, he says, keep the deal, as Secretary of State. Our Joint Chiefs, keep the deal. Intelligence heads, keep the deal. Previous opponents of the deal in Congress, including Senator Corker of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Senator Menendez and Senator Cardin, all of whom opposed the deal when it was up for Senate approval, say you got to keep the deal. Saudi Arabia, keep it. Israel, keep it. all our allies. Keep it. Why? Because it works. Because this deal has rolled back Iran's program. They have ripped out two-thirds of their centrifuges, gutted their plutonium production reactor, shipped their uranium gas out of the country, put their whole system under lock and camera, and it is stopping Iran from getting a bomb. It diplomatically stopped Iran's program, and nobody had to die. And it was free. You may have heard, oh, they got billions of dollars. It's true. It's billions of their own dollars that were frozen in banks because of the sanctions. They were doing business, then they had a nuclear program. We put on sanctions. The dollars are frozen in the bank. The nuclear program continued. We said, stop the nuclear program and you can get your money. They kept going. Finally, we get a deal. They stopped the nuclear program. We say, okay, now you can get your money. And we slowly release the money. They actually haven't gotten all of it yet. It's much more complicated to unwind sanctions than it is to put them on. They're still not happy. They think they should be getting more economic benefits. It is slow going. But the bomb program stopped in its tracks for a good 15 years. But it's not a perfect program. We didn't get everything we wanted. Can Donald Trump improve that deal? Yes, he can. Not by negotiating a new agreement. No, that agreement is there. But you can add to it. You can supplement it. You think they have too many centrifuges? Great, let's talk to them about reducing. You think that the terms of the deal expire too soon? Great, let's extend them. You want Iran to do more? They are willing to talk to us about doing more. What are we going to do? What's the deal? It's a transactional arrangement. They don't do it because they are afraid of us. They'll do it because they'll get something. So can Donald Trump get a better deal? It's possible. They call this more for more. The Iranians will do more if we do more. There are things that they want from us. We want things from them. It's possible you could get a deal. And these are the great three opportunities. I have to say, in the first 70 days or so, the arrows are not pointing in the right direction for any of these, with the possible exception of Iran. The fact that he hasn't done anything negative on Iran is a positive sign. North Korea, that's my bet for the first substantial international crisis that will test this administration. It's coming. North Korea is a small, impoverished country, but they have a robust and growing nuclear program. Right now, they have enough material for between 15 and 20 nuclear weapons, depending. They have short-range missiles that can reach South Korea and Japan. They do not have a missile that can reach us yet, but they're working on it. In the last 2 years, they've done more tests, nuclear and ballistic missile, than they've done in the entire history of their program. They're ramping it up. They're speeding ahead. Our assessment is that they almost have certainly perfected the miniaturization of a nuclear warhead. That is, taking a device that could be 5,000 pounds and 10 feet wide and shrinking it down to 1,000 pounds, 1,000 kilograms actually, and fitting it on the nose cone of a missile. We think they have that capability. They are testing solid fuel designs, a much more robust form of fuel for their missiles. They're testing new rocket engines. You may have seen they did an engine test. You put the test in a stand and you test it. Most of the experts that I associate with, some of whom we give grants to do their work, estimate that 3 to 4 years they could probably get a long-range ballistic missile with a nuclear warhead that could hit Los Angeles, hit the west coast of the United States. And that would shake our alliances. That's when Japan and South Korea start to think, are we willing to trade Los Angeles for Tokyo? Are we willing to trade Seattle for Seoul? So you do not want North Korea to get that capability. That's why if you're going to make a deal, you've got to do this soon. And that's why you need China's help. So you've seen a lot about China in the news this week. You turn on CNN, they're all talking China, Mar-a-Lago, Trump, North Korea. There's a lot to unpackage there, and maybe we can do some of that in Q&A. But if we do not come up with a strategic frame, a combination of force and incentives to to deal with North Korea. And then if we don't solve this in the next couple of years, it may become unsolvable. It may become impossible to get that North Korea to agree to anything at all. So those are the risks. Those are the opportunities. I am completely out of the prediction business. I had no idea who was going to win the presidential election. I don't know which of these risks or opportunities are going to happen. All we can do is identify the variables, identify the forces in motion, and keep watch. Thank you very much for letting me come and keep watch with you.
The mics are there. If you have a question, yes, I see them, Doug, thank you. If there's a question, please come to either the mic right over here or over there. And yes, sir.
How concerned is our government that Iran is using North Korea to develop its weapons?
Yeah. How concerned are we that North Korea and Iran are cooperating, or that Iran is using North Korea to develop its weapons? So there's no international treaty that bans Iran-North Korean relations, but there is an international obligation that prohibits Iran from developing or acquiring the technology for a nuclear weapon. So if we found out that Iran actually was cooperating with North Korea on nuclear weapons, that would be a violation of their treaty obligations. That would be a violation of the agreed framework. We could haul them before the UN. We could slap sanctions back and then consider doing other actions. Our intelligence on Iran is quite good. And I say that as someone who's held a security clearance for most of these last 8 years. We know a lot about Iran's program and their activities, more than most people appreciate. I would say that the Iranian-North Korean cooperation right now is mainly in the area of ballistic missiles. It's mainly been from North Korea to Iran. So North Korea perfected Scud technology that they got from the Russians. They developed this into longer-range Scuds. They call them no-dungs. They sold those Scuds to Pakistan, to Iran. Iran and Pakistan paint them different colors and call them different names, but they're basically North Korean missiles. But what happens is then those two countries develop those technologies further. Very smart people in Pakistan, very smart people in Iran, and they develop that rocket technology, so you start to see it flow back. So it's in the area of missile cooperation that I'd be looking more for this. Every once in a while, you see a story about an Iranian observer at a North Korean nuclear test. To the best of my understanding, our intelligence has never verified that. I don't think there's any intelligence that is true. So even though you see the stories, I don't believe we're particularly concerned that Iran is somehow violating the agreement by cooperating with North Korea on nuclear.
Next question from this side, please.
I have read that you have properly pointed out how the nuclear arsenals of the United States and Russia are so tremendously greater than those of the other nations. I have read that if there were a nuclear war between some of those other nations, it would be devastating, but it would not and human life on the planet. I have read that if the United States and Russia were to throw our nuclear weapons at each other, it very likely could bring about the end of human life on the planet. My question to you, first of all, is that last statement correct as far as you know? And if it is correct, it seems to me that people such as you and all those organizations should be focusing much more upon negotiating, lowering down the arsenals of the United States and Russia.
Thank you, Congressman. Thank you. This is Congressman Bedell, who served for many years with distinction in the U.S. House of Representatives. Thank you for that question. I've written a number of books on nuclear policy, but my real claim to fame is that I was interviewed by Stephen Colbert. And for a year or so, made me famous on college campuses. In fact, if you Google nuclear Colbert, you get me. And it's my interview, and toughest interview I ever did in my life. And in that interview, he says, how many weapons does it take to destroy the planet? And I gave him a number, and he said, okay, let's agree on that. Let's have that many weapons and no more. I said it would take about 300 nuclear weapons to destroy human civilization. The weapons we have now are many times more powerful than the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Each nuclear weapon in the U.S. arsenal is 10, 20, even 30 times more powerful. Even a minimum launch option that the president has in that suitcase could, well, let me put it this way. If he pulled out all the stops, if he launched all 900 nuclear weapons that are on hair trigger alert, ready to launch within minutes, he would have 900 weapons with about 20,000 Hiroshimas that would destroy everything human civilization has built over the millennia. No question about it. But it turns out it doesn't take that many to bring down human civilization. Scientists now estimate that if India and Pakistan got in a nuclear conflict, and they both have about 120 nuclear weapons each, they're engaged in a shooting war on their border, there are unresolved tensions that are getting worse. This is not a far-flung possibility. This could happen. If they exchange as few as 100 nuclear weapons in the heavily urbanized wooden areas of their country, those mega fires that would result would put enough smoke and particulates in the atmosphere to cloud the Earth for 2 to 3 years, dropping global temperatures 2 to 3 years. On a day like this, you think, eh. But what that means is that you kill most food crops in the world. And what that means is you set off a famine that scientists estimate could kill as many as 1 billion people. You put that kind of condition on this planet, that kind of starvation scenario, that kind of migration, you were talking about the end of human civilization. Would there be human beings? Yes. But you're well into Mad Max territory now. This is not a world we would want to live in. Are people working on this? Yes, people are working on this. I personally think that it's insane that we have this many weapons in our stockpiles. You are just asking for it. You got to be a real optimist to think that you can keep this number of nuclear weapons in fallible human hands and something terrible is not going to happen. Do I think we're going to convince people to give them up? No. But reduce them? Get down to hundreds rather than thousands? Greater controls? Not ready to launch? Yes, I think that is completely feasible. And again, this is the great opportunity. This is where Donald Trump could play a great role in bringing that Ronald Reagan vision of a world without nuclear weapons closer to a reality. Thank you, Congressman.
Somewhere out there are people with a question in their mind about this. You'll never get a better chance to put that question before anyone that can answer it any better than Joe Cirincione. So please, get to those mics. Next question from this side.
The Korean War ended with a ceasefire, and there's never been a peace agreement. And of course, as I understand that the North Koreans have been demanding for years that we sit down and negotiate with them, sign a peace treaty. How would that enter into any negotiations, and would this be something that they would like, that we could use and maybe help move an agreement along?
Right. You put your finger on a very important part of this problem. So I teach at graduate school at Georgetown University on international security, and we always tell our students, when you want to understand an international problem, see it from the other country's point of view. What do they want? What are their drivers? What is motivating them? And for the North Koreans, one of the things that motivates them is not the welfare of their own people. They clearly don't care about that. It's the security of the regime. They want to preserve the regime. And from their point of view, what they've been doing since the Korean War has worked. They are still there. This is a dynasty that has been handed down now 1, 2, 3 times. Kim Jong-un is the third member of the Kim family to be ruling that country. So they're not crazy. Crazy is when you do something and it hurts you. You do something that is against your interest. What they're doing works for them. These are rational leaders doing a cost-benefit analysis. One of the things they want is security. They would like a deal with us that helps guarantee the security of the regime. They would like a deal with us that helps them balance off China, a country that is their main patron, but is also a country that has occupied Korea several times over the last couple of centuries. That's the kind of thing they're looking for. So when we want to have negotiations with them, our demand is that they agree that the purpose of the negotiations is the elimination of their nuclear arsenal. They say the purpose of the negotiations has to be a peace treaty. That's what they want, an official end to the Korean War, a recognition of them, you know, and guarantees that we will not attack them, that we will not threaten their security. Apart from that, there's huge prestige in reaching an agreement with the United States. A picture of Kim Jong-un with Donald Trump? I know, it's kind of weird. Short, tall, it's big. But that is of enormous value to somebody like Kim Jong-un, of enormous value. Okay, so what's it worth? What are you willing to give? Again, this is transactional. It's not ideological. Can the great deal maker make a deal? It's out there. It's possible. If you give up the idea that there's a military solution to this problem, and I don't think there is, then you're in the world of, well, what's the deal? And so, yeah, there's stuff North Korea wants, and we got to figure out how much they're willing to give for it.
Next question from this side, please.
We've heard reports that the U.S. military arsenal, nuclear arsenal, particularly the missile system, is in pretty woeful repair. Mm-hmm. It isn't well maintained, whereas the Russians have been scrambling to make theirs fresh, alive, and ready to roll. Can you comment on that particular
sure.
issue?
We have the best nuclear weapons in the world. There's not a single military commander that would trade our arsenal for Russia's or anybody else's. We have superb nuclear weapons. What you're hearing is that the nuclear weapons complex itself, the process that sort of makes the warheads, is in various stages of disrepair, and that's true. That is true. You will see pictures of buildings with leaks, of doors propped open at nuclear command and control centers with bricks because they can't be kept open. It's true that a lot of our equipment for some of the command and control, it runs on floppy disks. You guys all know what floppy disks are, but there's not fewer and fewer people have ever seen a floppy disk. Yeah, that's true. And that's why we spend approximately $30, $35 billion a year on the nuclear weapons complex and the nuclear weapons. But there's two parts of it. One is, what do you need to repair the complex? And then the second part is, well, how big does the complex need to be, and do you need a new generation of weapons? And that's where the big money comes in. And this is what you hear. Right now, the United States has a plan started under Obama, continued under Trump so far, to build a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, brand new submarines, brand new bombers, brand new missiles, brand new warheads, for about $1 trillion over the next 25 years. $1 trillion just on the nuclear weapons to completely replicate the force we have. You cut that force down. You decide that you don't need the ICBMs, that the subs and the bombers are fine, you could save hundreds of billions of dollars that you could apply to some of the other things we need, like planes and tanks and ships to fight the wars that we do need, like better cyber defenses and cyber command and control. Oh yeah, I gotta talk about the relationship of cyber to nuclear in a minute. So yes, there's stuff we have to do. Are other countries ahead of us? No. What happens is that countries' weapons retire and age at different rates. Both we and the Soviets went through the last great nuclear buildup in the 70s and 80s. And we both built massive amounts. Maybe you remember the debate over the MX missile and the B-1 and the B-2 bomber and the et cetera. Well, that's when we built them all. I was in the House Armed Services Committee at the time in charge of tracking those programs. Well, they're all wearing out. And the Russian weapons wear out faster. So that's why you see the Russians now building a new ICBM. That's why you see them building new subs. They're a little sort of ahead of us in the cycle, But there is an arms race going on, make no doubt about it. Ours are just a little further down the pipeline. But for example, in the budget we just passed and in this budget, in the 2016 budget, the 2017 budget, there was a $1.2 billion each year for a new submarine. It's being developed, it's being designed. There's unknown number billions of dollars for a new strategic bomber. John McCain is very upset that the budget figure is classified. He wants to unclassify it. There's billions of dollars for new programs, and here's the problem, and here's the confrontation, and this is why this issue transcends conservative and liberal issues. The bow wave for this thing is going to hit in the mid-2020s. So around 2021, 2025, all these programs that are planned, they all start going into production, and that's when the big money comes. But we planned more programs than the budget can afford, so there is going to be a crunch here. But if you keep going with these nuclear programs, you're not going to be able to fund the conventional weapons that you want. Example, the Navy shipbuilding budget. In 2025, half the Navy shipbuilding budget will be devoted to nuclear weapons, to a brand new nuclear sub. That means it can't build aircraft carriers, frigates, destroyers, ships that we actually use, and instead we'd be building the new nuclear sub. What's the answer to that? I say cut the weapons. Put the money for the weapons that you need, not the nuclear weapons that are obsolete from a war that's been over for 25 years. Other people say raise the entire defense budget. This thing, so increase the size of the pie. This is all going to be hashed out over the next couple of years. It's one of the big policy issues that you'll see. Not just do we increase the defense budget, but do we increase the nuclear budget? Do we spend more on nuclear weapons? And it's different from do we modernize our complex, everybody agrees, yes. It's do you build a whole new generation of weapons?
From this side, please.
With the negotiations with Iran, if we had one, what do they want?
What is Iran? Iran wants two things. One, they're dissatisfied with the deal. They thought they were going to get a bigger economic kick out of this than they've gotten. And the reason is that it's been so difficult to disentangle the sanctions that banks, companies still are hesitant to invest in Iran. So while there's been new activity in Iran, there hasn't been this big bump, this big wave that they thought they were going to get. This factors into the upcoming presidential elections. On May 19th, Iran's having elections for their president. Mr. Rouhani, who negotiated the deal, thought he'd be getting a big bump because the population would be happy with the new and improved economy. They haven't really felt the economic condition. Whether he is reelected or not is an open question. Iran actually has a kind of democracy. It's not a dictatorship like North Korea. The second thing they want is greater recognition, a greater role in regional affairs. We see this as Iran expanding its role, as pushing into regional affairs. They see this as something that's natural given their size of their economy, their natural role in the region. Our close allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, want to bottle Iran back up. They don't want them to have more influence in the area. You see this expressed in terms of military conflict. For example, the Iranians are backing the Houthis in Yemen. So strange, we now know these terms. The Houthi, something we never heard about 2 years ago. This is the rebel group that overthrew the president of Yemen several years ago. The Saudis are backing the overthrown president of Yemen. There is a shooting war going on in Yemen that's been going on now for 18 months to almost 2 years. The Saudis have killed about 10,000 civilians in bombing raids. We see this as part of the power struggle. Saudi Arabia wants to push back on Iran militarily. But there's a other dimension of diplomacy, of relations between states, and this is starting to change as a result of the Iran deal. Most of our allies in the Gulf are in something called the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC. They just met a few days ago, March 31st, I think, and are exploring the idea of a new diplomatic initiative with Iran. And that's part of what Iran would like. So a deal with the United States could involve, yes, the nuclear issue and greater restraints on their program, but it would also involve some of the politics of this, perhaps some of the resolution of some of these both military conflicts and diplomatic issues that are still roiling the Middle East.
Another question from the left side here.
To the best of my knowledge, there are no great laboratories or universities, at least that we've heard about, in North Korea. Where does the scientific expertise come from? Is it imported? Is it indigenous? What role do the Chinese play in that?
Excellent question. The question is, how did the North Koreans learning how to do this? There aren't any great universities in North Korea. Where do these scientists and engineers come from? Well, there are some universities in North Korea, and quite a bit of the budget has been devoted to the military sciences and to the military engineering projects. And so this has grown over the years. We tend to lose track of time, of how long it's been. And there have been several generations of North Koreans now raised since the Korean War. Originally, they benefited tremendously from the Soviet Union. That was their great patron. And again, North Korea saw the Soviets as a balance against China, their historic enemy. Japanese, the Chinese, they both invaded the Korean Peninsula over the years. And there was a great deal of technology flowing in from the Soviet Union. That's where they got their first reactor, a research reactor, legal under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Agreement. It was supposed to be for civilian purposes, but that's what they used to start their bomb program. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, for monetary reasons, the Russians no longer could provide that kind of support. Most of their military equipment was Soviet, the tanks, the rockets, the planes. The Chinese then stepped in and sort of became their chief patron and supplied some of their expertise. Interestingly, this engine that they're testing, that they just tested, there's some indication that that is an actual, it's a Russian engine, with an R-27, it's actually called. And did the Russians give that to them? This is an unknown, this is a mystery. That would be against the restrictions that are placed on North Korea. Did some Russian company give it to them? Quite possible. North Korea's got money, they're able to buy some of this technology. I would say the North Korean program could not have advanced without the Russian and Chinese help, but they are fairly independent right now. They've had decades now of engineering expertise, and believe me, the incentives for succeeding at the job are quite high.
Do we have another question on this side?
Thank you, first of all, for these incredible strategic perspectives. I'm really...
You're welcome.
I really, really appreciate that.
Thank you.
The last fellow here asked, what does Iran want? And I wonder what China wants out of this Korea situation.
Ah, yes.
And it appears to me that the urgency of it to them, the Chinese, is a bit less than the urgency of it to us.
Yes.
And that this may simply be one of many parts of the equation when China looks at us and maybe don't feel the same way about bringing it to an early conclusion. Mm-hmm. Just wondered what your thoughts on that.
Again, you got to look at it from the Chinese point of view. What do the Chinese want? The Chinese have no problem with North Korea being a thorn in the side to Japan and the United States and causing us to spend a lot of money and distract a lot of attention and threaten our alliance structure. That's fine with them. They got no problem with that. What they don't want is North Korea being so provocative that it stimulates and then justifies a Japanese military buildup on their border, a U.S. military buildup on their border, greater involvement of the United States in Northeast Asia, particularly the deployment of missile defense systems in Japan and South Korea, which the Chinese see, not without cause, as aimed at them, really, using the excuse of the North Korean missiles. That's what they don't want to see. They do not want a nuclear North Korea. They are not happy with North Korea. In fact, I would say relations between China and North Korea are probably the worst they've been in decades. In decades. China has carefully cultivated its own group of supporters in the North Korean regime, including Kim Jong-un's uncle, who Kim Jong-un killed. This was a Chinese guy. This was his uncle. This was one of 320 officials and generals that Kim Jong-un has assassinated, and sometimes in grotesque ways, strapping him to the barrel of an artillery rifle, an anti-air gun, and blowing their parts to kingdom come, so disgracing in Korean tradition. In fact, in many traditions, you want to have a body to mourn. For some of these officials, there is no body. This is Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un just killed his half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, as he was transiting Malaysia. This was a man under Chinese protection. This was not a political man. He was said to be somewhat dim-witted. It's like Michael killing Fredo in The Godfather. What are you doing this for? Because Kim Jong-un saw him as a threat. He had an hereditary claim to the throne, and he eliminated him. And this really ticked off the Chinese. This was a direct slap in the face to the Chinese, which is why, a week later, they cut off their import of coal to China. This is all from North Korea to China. This represented about 40% of North Korea's export earnings. There's not a lot of stuff that North Korea exports. Coal is one of them, and their primary customer is China, and China stopped it. So China is willing to squeeze North Korea. They would like there to be talks between the United States and North Korea and the other countries to contain and roll back North Korea's nuclear program. But what they don't want more than anything else is a collapsed North Korea, a regime that falls apart, that would lead to millions of North Koreans fleeing over the borders, destabilizing the situation in the Chinese provinces that border North Korea. The South Koreans don't want this either, destabilizing South Korea. What they don't want is a regime that collapses and somehow comes under South Korean control. A unified Korea, maybe with nuclear weapons, allied with the United States? No. So you can see, as you start to look at this from China's point of view, there's a game they want to play. There's a solution that they want. They call it a soft landing. And increasingly, it's getting difficult to see how you do that soft landing. But everybody wants to avoid the hard landing, the collapse of the regime that leads to this kind of chaos. We practice military operations to try and go into a collapsed North Korea and seize the nuclear weapons, but we're not clear where they are. Our intelligence on North Korea is much less than our intelligence in other countries. Very hard to get human intel in North Korea. So you can see what a complicated problem this is. There really is no ideal solution. There's no quick fix. And just saying China's got to fix it for us, that ain't going to work. That ain't going to work. That's a dead end. Or saying we should go in and do a military strike, that ain't going to work. And here's why. Even if you knew where the North Korean weapons were, even if you had conventional weapons, which we do, that could be pinpoint accurate and take them out, you don't take out the 10,000 artillery tubes and rockets that they have on the DMZ within range of Seoul. Estimates are that several hundred thousand South Koreans would die in the first few hours of a conventional war. So you don't want that. So you've got to find, this is why I don't say this because I'm ideologically predisposed towards diplomacy, even though I am. I say it because this is the practical choice. That when you look at all these other terrible options, it drives you to a negotiated solution, as tough as that is, as potentially emotionally unsatisfying as it is, as odious as it is to think about Donald Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un. That may be the way we solve the North Korean crisis.
The last two questions on the left.
I guess I'm yes. Thank you very much.
I'm picking up speed here.
and you will with this one, I think. Didn't you just make a comment that you think we need to talk about cyber warfare also?
Oh, yeah.
That's another whole right?
Yeah. This is worse than you... Is that it? That's the question? Cyber war is worse than you think. It's... If you get a chance, there's this wonderful film called Zero Days. Zero Days. It's a documentary about the cyber warfare we conducted against Iran, the so-called Stuxnet virus, that successfully destroyed 1,000 Iranian centrifuges by taking over the computers that were operating the centrifuges and speeding up the centrifuges and slowing them down, until they crashed, until they broke. And while this is all happening, the computer operators didn't know it because the program was sending back messages to the operators that everything was fine. It's like those heist movies where they send the video back that the vault is empty when the guys are drilling through the door. It was exactly that kind of program, a brilliant program, but it was the first time that cyber warfare made the leap from software stealing information to controlling hardware, to controlling physical things. And if we can do it, they can do it. If we can control machines, they can control machines. Iran, North Korea, Russia, China, no question about it, they could take over machinery that we have. Air traffic control, railroad switches, stock market, dams. This threat of cyber warfare doesn't end at industrial machines. It also includes nuclear weapons. You think your nuclear weapons are under your control? Really? How do you know? How do you know? In this movie, Zero Days, it ends by an operative saying, Stuxnet was just the beginning. We had other programs ready in case we did have to go to war with Iran that would have taken over Iranian defenses. They would push the button and nothing would happen. If we can do it, they can do it. And if you can stop a button that is being pushed from launching a missile, can you have a button that hasn't been pushed from launching that missile? And if you think your nuclear weapons are protected because they're not on the internet, think again. This so-called air gap is easily bridged. Oh, and wait, the Air Force has a plan to put our nuclear weapons on the internet. To improve command and control by netting up all our nuclear weapons into a computerized system that can improve our command and control of those weapons. Don't these people watch Hollywood movies? Don't they know where that ends? So there are real serious risks out there from cyber warfare. It is one of the things that frightens people the most now in this current environment. It's not just Russian hacking of Democratic Party or party computers and getting information. It's real cyber warfare that goes right after the core interests, the core capabilities that we have and that they have, including our nuclear weapons. And that's one of the reasons I think we have to reduce our numbers of nuclear weapons as much as possible, take them off hair trigger alert, make it as hard to launch your nuclear weapons as possible, consistent with our security concerns. There are real serious threats out there. It is not the Cold War anymore. It is the 21st century, and it is an even scarier place.
With that terrible thought, to take
you
back tonight.
Thank you very much.